Hello and welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners and podcast listeners everywhere. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx.
She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York. Follow her voice, a straight dog is nice. She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, oh yeah. Don't be surprised if you wanna listen twice. Make decisions, find the right choice. Know yourself better, find your own voice. It's okay if you need help today, cause everybody needs a little push. From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.
This weekly show, Everybody Needs a Little Push, with Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, will be aired every Wednesdays on Transformation Talk Radio and podcast stations everywhere at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. I am delighted to bring you my weekly podcast program, which I hope will inspire you, coach you,
sometimes make you laugh,
and give you the push moment you need to move forward. And I'm going to do it the pushy Broadway. Straight up. No BS, easy, quick, with answers, suggestions, and directions that will give you a coaching experience that will be part cheerleader and part drill sergeant. Because everybody needs a little push from time to time. And here comes yours.
Everybody, 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 everybody needs a little push.
Everybody needs a little push.
Everybody, 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 everybody needs a little push.
Today's episode is an interview with a life coaching client of mine, actor and playwright Michael O'Leary. Michael will be sharing some wonderful stories about his acting career and its beginnings. He will also share some interesting tidbits about one of the longest-running TV soap operas, Guiding Light, where Michael played a prominent role for close to 26 years. He's also going to talk to us about the very personal and poignant story behind his new play, Breathing Under Dirt. See if you can recognize Michael's push moments, the defining moments in his life where he changed direction or took a definitive leap forward. So here, for your enjoyment and listening pleasure, is my interview with Michael O'Leary. The Pushy Broad from the Bronx is delighted to have Michael O'Leary in the studio today. Michael has spent some time on a very popular soap opera in this country called Guiding Light. Michael's role was to play Dr. Rick Bauer.
That's right. Yeah, I started the show on a Friday as an orderly, and on Monday I was doing brain surgery. So over the weekend I went to, I guess, a crash medical course. And then I proceeded to set a record for killing 43 patients.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
How long were you on Guiding Light, Michael?
Started in 1983 and until the show was canceled in 2009.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And Dr. Rick Bauer was married, single?
I was much happier single. Marriage didn't fit Dr. Rick. I married a rainbow coalition of women, African-American, white, prostitutes, deaf Amish virgins. Actually, the deaf Amish virgin was the best marriage until she got her hearing back and she left me. It's a true story.
My goodness. Yeah, yeah. How many times were you married on the show?
7.
I think that's Elizabeth Taylor's record, isn't it?
I think she was 12. And if the show continued on for a couple more years, I think I would have hit 12.
It would have been more.
Yeah.
When did Guiding Light first become a soap?
1935. It started as a radio show. Reverend Rutledge, which was an actual person, answered phone calls from parishioners, and they decided to give him a family, and Sherita Bauer, the story goes, walked into a radio station looking for a job, and lo and behold, they said, you know, we'll just make that make her part of the family, and make her Reverend Rutledge's wife, and that's how it started, and they just said, let's build a family around her, and that's how Guiding Light got started.
So it was almost a kind of a spiritual thing.
It was.
Guiding light.
Yeah, it was a spiritual show with no intentions of being what it became. It was just a minister answering phone calls.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And when did it air?
1935.
On radio.
And 1952, TV? It started on 1953. Started on television.
Black and white.
Black and white, yeah.
And you said you came on in 1985?
I started in 1983.
You were a youngster.
I was, right out of college.
How'd you get the job?
Great story. I was an usher for The Price is Right and for Match Game and all these game shows. I'm dating myself, but what the heck. And there was a day where Guiding Light was in the studio and they were doing auditions. There was no role for a man. However, that didn't stop me from crashing the audition, which I did. I walked in there looking for a job. And Betty Ray, God rest her soul, one of the preeminent casting directors of all time and just a great lady, said, you know, I read for her. She said, you know, you're a good actor, but, you know, could you read with these 10 young ladies? And we'll pay you $400 or $500. And it was a romantic kissing scene. And I thought, well, you know, my love life wasn't on fire. It was great to make $400 or $500. So I did it.
Kissing 10 women.
10 women.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you're the best. No, you're the best. You're the best. How many times I said that? No, you're great. No, you hit it out of the park. Nice job. So 10 women later, $400 in my pocket. I go home and I walked in the house and there's my mom watching The Guiding Light, which she's watched forever. Phone rings. This is all true story. Phone rings. It's my agent in Beverly Hecht in Los Angeles. She goes, Michael, you're not going to believe this, but they saw your screen test in New York and they fired the Rick Bauer that was on the show and you're replacing him.
Wow.
That was on a Tuesday. On a Friday, I was on an airplane heading to New York to play this character, which I did for 25 years.
That's a great story. I know you have lots of fans, and now yeah. They know how good a kisser you really are.
Well, I didn't get any dates out of that. None of those 10 women said, you know, can you call me? So I don't know if I was hitting out of the park, quite honestly, Ellen.
Well, it landed you a very long and lustrous career.
It did, yep.
And how did things end on Guiding Light?
You know, it got to a point where we were all kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. I think the OJ trial was the beginning of the end for us when
really?
People, yeah, the trial, when the Bronco was going down 405 freeway and our show kept getting interrupted and we would literally sit there and watch it and watch the news interrupt our show. And then there was this thing called Court TV and this thing called cable and all of a sudden network television was the landscape of that was going to change. And that directly affected daytime soap operas. And we had, I don't know, 9 or 10 million people watching us when I was on the show back in 83. And then when that happened, our ratings just dropped like an anvil because women were starting getting more into the workplace and this thing called cable started to happen. So the audience, a dissemination of the audience started to happen. And we went from 10 million to 2.5 million people by the time the show went off the air.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Have there ever been any rumors about a resurgence of Guiding Light?
That happened quite frequently, but I don't think Procter & Gamble, they were approached several times by NBC and others to resurrect it. And I think since a lot of these soaps have been canceled, there's only four left, by the way, some of the networks had misgivings because some of the other programming they put on was not as popular, but it just never got legs.
I see. So you got out of school and wanted to be an actor. Was that what your dreams were?
I think from a pretty early age, I knew that I liked to be the center of attention. Might as well just say that because that's what it was. And I did all the school plays and I started doing some modeling and that led to commercials. And I was working a lot. You know, I had this sort of all-American face. I was did one commercial after another. But I didn't really think of it as a profession at the time. It was just fun. And then a woman named Stella Adler changed my life.
How so?
She came to Los Angeles. And for those, you know, listening to the podcast today, Stella Adler is considered one of the preeminent acting teachers that ever lived from the Stanislavski School in Russia. She came back and taught the method. she came to Los Angeles, did a script interpretation of Tennessee Williams' play. That's the one with
Cat?
Blanche.
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
No, it was Blanche.
Blanche DuBois?
Blanche DuBois. Right out of my mind.
This is ridiculous. Streetcar Named Desire.
Yes. Right. And she showed how she worked on the character. And it was just, here was this, and I think she was 80 years old at the time. Here was this woman who was 80 years old, who had so much charisma and energy and life and positive feelings. And she's teaching a bunch of young actors about how to work on Blanche. And it was a character development class, script interpretation is what it was. And from that moment, when I saw that, I knew I wanted to become an actor. So we talk about those life-changing moments.
Yes.
It was just, hey, I'm making some good money. This is fun to, no, this is a craft.
How old were you?
I was probably 21 or 22 years old, something like that.
So that was a changing moment for you.
It was transformative. It was a push moment. It was a life of meandering, as I was at 21, making money, but
having a great time, modeling, hanging out with the ladies,
yeah,
you know, being in the limelight,
yeah,
all of those things.
It was, but there was no there and the there,
yeah,
as they say. And man, I just saw her and I said, whatever she has, I want what that is. And so I studied with her script interpretation class and her technique class when she came out to Los Angeles. And then shortly after that, I got the show on The Guiding Light and the story that I just told you. But I went out to New York, but I really was not, I wouldn't consider myself a trained actor. And right away when I got to New York, I signed up for Bill Esper's technique class, and Bill is from the mm-hmm. Meisner School of
sure.
Acting, and I loved it. And I kind of did it backwards. I got the show before I really became a trained actor, but I knew that I wanted to learn the craft, even though I was on the soap opera and you get all those accolades. Somebody once told me about adulation. It tastes great, but it's like cotton candy. It tastes great, but you're still hungry afterwards.
Yes.
So true. All of this great stuff was happening to me, but I was so scared because I thought I had no idea what I was doing. So I did have the forethought to say, okay, you need to get an acting class, which I did. And I started studying with Bill Esper in New York and loved it. And then became what I felt was a trained actor. It's sort of like law school. You know, unless you're Jodie Foster or a couple of other people who can just walk in front of the camera and just be fantastic, that wasn't me. I knew I had to learn the craft.
Well, also, too, it gave you a different sense of responsibility, some accountability, yeah. some structure, some balance,
right.
and understanding that it was not just a job. It had become a profession.
Exactly. I wanted to, and had I not met... You know, we all have those life-defining moments, but had I not met Stella Adler, I don't know if I would have had that same feeling going into it, because I thought, here's what art is. Here's what real art is.
Right.
Here's an artist.
Right.
This is a inspiring artist who said, look, when you walk out the door and you're doing a Tennessee Williams piece or you're doing Anna Christie by Eugene O'Neill, understand the histrionics of that. Do your homework. Great craftspeople do their homework before they ever step on the stage.
Yes.
And she taught me that it's a craft. And I had the wonderful opportunity to work with Larry Moss. And Larry was a student of Stella Adler. And now he's directing my play.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, wow. I can't even put into words
When did this become an inception, an idea?
Well, I've always, up till 15, 20 years ago, I loved writing, but I didn't have any discipline with it or any formal training with it. So I wrote this play called Red Rain back around early 2001, 2002. And...
What was that about, briefly?
My father was a rageaholic.
Uh-huh.
Abusive. And the play is about, it's sort of like, The Great Santini is one of those movies that really stuck with me. And for those who don't know that movie, it's about a war within the house.
Yes.
It was Robert Duvall after a war, I think it was between the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my home growing up as a kid. And so,
you were the oldest of five?
Oldest of four.
Oldest of four.
Right.
And two other brothers and a sister.
Right, all younger than me. And so the war was inside of our house. And so the play is about, my mother was about peace, my father was about war, and all of that was happening within the confines of our house. And so my father was preparing me to be a warrior, and my mother was about peace.
Mm.
So you had those two powerful themes colliding.
Right.
And
kind of like War of the Roses.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, exactly. And so my father got out of North Korea being a Marine, and he saw what war was like. And so I think some respect, I was too young for Vietnam, but I was 15. I mean, Vietnam ended in 73, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so his thought was, I'm going to prepare you for war, because the history of man is war. And my mother was thought differently. And I think it's a good play. And that play, ironically, gave birth to the play that I'm doing now.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it was you, Ellen.
It was me?
You. Yes, I'm going to give you credit now. Because I've been working with you for 5 years. And now, you know, it just occurred to me that I called
your
you one day.
Your push moment.
My
came
push
when
moment
when?
When I called you and I said, she goes, what is it you want to do? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I just gotten divorced and my life was, you know, very difficult. And you said, you know, I have a play. And you said, get that play out of your computer and get a couple of actors and ask help. Say, ask five people for help. And that's what I did. I asked for help for five things. And one of which was I asked two friends of mine, two very accomplished actors, to read the play.
Mm-hmm.
And they read it. And we went to a coffee shop, and it was read. And they said, wow, Michael, this is really good. Can I take it to New York and show so-and-so? And I said, sure. So he took it to New York. And he said, well, the artistic director liked your play, but he wants the female role expanded. Can you expand the female role? So I went to work. I went to the coffee shop. I wrote a monologue of that female character as a writing exercise, separate from that play. So the monologue was this woman, her life prior to the play. And after I wrote the monologue, I go, oh my God, there's a play here.
Yes.
There's a play about this woman.
And this brilliant play, by the way, is called Breathing Under Dirt.
That's it. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And so this character is most writers, and I'm not, you know, any different than that, is this female character is really me. And it's about a mother and daughter during the early 1950s in the South.
Why did you decide to make the character female?
You know, I have this respect for women. And this idea of history, I love history. And I think women have been underestimated, underrepresented, particularly about when you think about, I'm a student of history, I love the idea of the Depression and how people got through the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And
personal struggles.
And women are a big part of that in many respects. When I look at my grandmother and grandfathers, my grandmother's the one who really got our family through the Depression.
I see.
So that really stuck with me.
And so you replaced the role of you and your father.
Right.
For a daughter and a mother.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah. So Patience was Michael, and Grace was my father, and maybe five or six other people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
Ostensibly, the play is really about forgiveness.
Is it?
Yeah.
And so it's set in the Deep South?
Deep South, 1953.
53.
And there is an affinity I have for the South. maybe because I'm Irish, but there's something about the land, farmland. I love Eugene O'Neill. I love Yeats and mm-hmm. Beckett and all the Irish, the writers. There's something transformative about the land, the
yes.
dirt.
Yes, part of the story.
Yeah.
Like Gone with the Wind.
Exactly, exactly. So it's about a mother and daughter in the early 1950s. Part of the backdrop to this is the father is a raging, he's an alcoholic who's passed.
Mm-hmm.
His spirit is throughout the whole play. And the daughter idolizes her father to something that he never was. And the mother really is the one who got them through. And she, they don't have any relationship whatsoever. Because this young lady, when she was growing up, was an accomplished pianist. Everything that she did was not quite enough to make her mother happy.
She could never measure up.
She never can measure up. So there's a futility of that. But there's a love underneath all of that, too, because it's the daughter who's taking care of the mother who is elderly. She helps her take a bath. They need each other, but they hate each other.
Yes.
There's this duality that
very
happens.
Very typical love-hate relationship.
Exactly.
Well, I had the pleasure of seeing maybe a vignette mm-hmm. of this play
right.
when you did it, and it was only about 20 minutes long,
mm-hmm.
and it did win an award, did it not?
Yeah,
for the 20 minutes?
It won Best One Act at the Manhattan Repertory One Act Festival.
Yes, it
out
did.
Out of 30 plays, and it won Best Play. So that, and all it was 20 pages of a play, of an idea, really.
An idea.
Yeah.
That was very personal to you.
Very personal to me.
And then it evolved.
Well, because of social media, and for all budding writers and actors and playwrights out there, you can't do anything without social media. The power of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, because of my participation in Guiding Light, which certainly helped, people got wind of the show, of the one-act play being winning an award, and they say, hey, bring it here, bring it here. And I'm thinking, well, I only have 20 minutes of a play. So I spent April, the month of April of last year, and I just wrote the rest of the play in 1 month. And I asked my friends from Guiding Light, Grant Alexander, Beth Chamberlain, and Tina Sloan, and I asked them for help. And they said yes.
And they said yes.
Yes, they did.
That's a really big deal, yes.
It is a big deal.
It's hard to ask for help. And
well, that's,
go ahead.
That's one of the things you coached me on, which was ask for help. Because, you're always surprised how people will, strangers sometimes, will give you help that you're not expecting.
Completely out of nowhere.
Exactly.
And then you have that old stigma of you're not so sure if your work is good enough.
Yes,
right?
Yes, of course.
And you don't want somebody to help and turn around and say, oh my God, this is horrible.
Well,
that kind of confidence.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's a point which I reached, which was, and I've never had this voice, which is I'm not going to be denied.
There you go.
Yeah. And I actually had that voice in me, so I'm not going to be denied.
Good for
and
you.
And so it didn't occur to me or think, I didn't worry about the material or if it was good enough. I just thought this is something that that seems predestined, that I'm going to do it and nothing's going to stop me. I never had that voice before.
That's marvelous.
Yeah.
Well, I hope in some way I could contribute to that over the years.
Well, you did, because you simply gave me an action plan. You said ask for, and two of the five things worked out, the other three didn't. But that's okay.
Yes, it is.
I mean, I'll take a 40, whatever that is, 400%
right,
batting average,
right.
You know?
Well, you know what they say, every single no leads you closer to a yes. But you have to go out there and get those no's.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the thing that I've never been, I mean, there's plenty of shortcomings that I have, but one of them is not worried about the no.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get no's
yes,
all the time.
Yes, especially in the acting profession. I mean, you wouldn't
right.
be anywhere without the no's.
Well, absolutely, because I think as we were speaking earlier before we started the podcast, is 90% of the time you're going to get a no.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason while any budding, and I tell all my actors that I coach, take a writing class, learn to produce. You have the internet. I produced a web series with virtually no money in my pocket. In fact, I produced the play. I think I had $100 in my wallet last year.
There you go.
That's it. And I thought, well, how am I going to do that? Well, there's a way of doing it. And I collaborated with a theater in Maryland who paid for everything.
Right.
And it's a nonprofit theater group. And they said, well, hey, we'll put it up and
marvelous.
Make it and just get it up. It was only three performances, but those three performances, just being able to do it, we only had three rehearsals. Can you imagine doing a play with three
amazing.
Rehearsals?
But you made it real.
Yeah.
It came out of your head, which was in the computer.
Right.
It came out of your head into something tangible and real and yeah. visible.
Yeah.
And that gave it momentum.
It did. And, you know, I think all you have in your life, too, is your reputation. And I think, you know, I always tell people karma remembers all the addresses.
Mm.
And so you always, especially, you know, I really believe in the word ensemble. I really believe that the collectivism of things, when you think of great television shows like the Mary Tyler Moore
yes.
Show, Frasier.
Of course,
designing
ensemble
women,
casts.
Ensemble
right.
casts. So when one person says, hey, I'm better, and they leave, it never works out.
Never. And they always get replaced by somebody as good or better.
They do. But great shows have great ensembles.
Yes.
And so I'm a big believer that, you know, you pick people on your team that are going to move the ball forward.
Exactly.
You know, who are there, you know.
And that also means that, to some extent, you take your ego out of it. Because it's not
yeah.
only
yeah.
about you and what you've done.
Yeah.
You allow others to put their creative input into something so that the ensemble actually works, because you get stronger with the ideas of the collective
right.
rather than one individual.
The key for me is knowing what I don't know and letting people who do know what they do know do what they do.
There you go.
You know, and my buddy Grant Alexander, he directed it. He starred in it. He helped me produce it. I could have never in a million years pulled this off without having him. Yeah.
So it went from a 20-minute little kind of vignette, a one act, that you won an award for.
Right.
And by the time you got it put up, where in Maryland, you
mm-hmm.
said?
Right.
How long was the play?
80 minutes.
80 minutes long.
Right.
No interruptions.
No,
no
interruptions.
Intermissions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
then what happened?
Well, now it's like, okay, now what do I do? We all had this great time in Maryland, and now I just have this play. And
to excellent reviews.
Yes, I had great reviews from a Washington, D.C. critic. Cynthia Watt, I mean, everybody was spectacular. Grant and Cynthia and Tina Sloan just hit it out of the park. Now it's like, okay, now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
So I was lucky enough to have a relationship with a Broadway producer who happened to like Guiding Light. And I just give him a call. I say, hey, what would you do in my situation? And again, asking for help. And he said, well, if I were you, I would, you know, get a small venue like a Cherry Lane Theater or something like that. And do a stage reading for industry professionals.
There you go.
So I said, well, okay. So who would you suggest? And he goes, well, you have to have somebody who's a director who has... who's respected in the theater community.
Yes, the clout and credibility.
Right. And he gave me some names. But on the top of that list, he said, you know, a guy like Larry Moss, who I happened to study with 25 years ago for a short period of time. And I thought, well, what the heck? You know, all he can do is say no.
So for those of us who don't know, what's Larry Moss's reputation like? What has he directed?
Larry is considered the preeminent acting teacher of our time.
Mm-hmm.
Larry is the new Stella Adler.
There you go.
And Larry is the kindest man I have ever met in my entire life. So I sent the script to him, and I had to track down his assistant. And I hadn't seen, like I said, I hadn't seen Larry in 25 years. So I sent the script to him. I didn't hear anything. Getting nervous, you know, thinking what I'm going to do. And again, I want to keep my cast together for the stage reading. And then I got a call from Larry. Like 5 weeks later, I'm driving my car up to the house. And then Larry called and he said, "Hey, Michael, how are you?" And I said, "Who is this?" And he goes, "It's Larry Moss." And I go, "Larry?" And he goes, "Yeah, how are you, dear friend?" I said, he goes, "I read your play." He goes, "I think it's just absolutely creative and wonderful. How can I help you?" And I said, "What do you think of directing it?" And he said, "I would love to."
That's marvelous.
And, you know, I sat in the car with him on the phone and I cried, because this is a dream, you know, a dream come true to have somebody like Larry Moss, who, you know, he's directing motion pictures now. And he, you know, for him to spend the time with this play and the subject matter is just something I can't even put words on. So where we are now is we did the stage reading with Larry directing it.
That was another push moment for you. Larry saying to you, "I'd be honored to direct your play."
Right.
That was another push forward.
That was. And he said, "You just tell me what you need. You tell me what you need, and I will do it." And I said, "I think we need 3 days of rehearsal." And he said, "Okay, that's it." So, you know, he came in, and Tina Sloan, who plays Grace in the play, was gracious enough to let her use her home on the Upper East Side. And we rehearsed really hard for 3 days, and I got Robert Bogue to come in to replace Grant, to play John.
Right.
And, you know, we put it up and went very well.
Where was it put up?
The Cherry Lane Theater.
Uh-huh. And when was that?
It was January 24th, just a couple months ago. And now we're in a very, you know, I'm remiss to say where we are now. We're in a very exciting phase where somebody is interested in the play in New York, and we're going to take the play to some pretty amazing people, and we'll see what happens next.
And how has the play evolved in terms of character development and length and scope?
The play's now an hour and a half.
It is.
Yeah. Larry has, I'll give you an example, and for people who are budding writers out there, the play's called Breathing Under Dirt. And Larry, first thing he said to me, goes, "You know, Michael, I think, and it's just a suggestion, this is the way he talks to me, he goes, I would go back and take the word breathing and dirt out as many times as humanly possible. Because since it's the name of the play, we don't want to hit people over the head with it." It was brilliant. So I went back and found 54 places where breathing and dirt.
Oh, my goodness. In the script?
In the script.
Where breathing and dirt were there?
Yeah. So all of a sudden, the play felt like it was 100 pounds lighter.
Wow.
So I removed those words out of the script. And then he said, because there was a spiritual theme in the play, he said, be judicious in the word God, in the use of God. Because all of these, when you use words, you want to be judicious because there's a power in those
words.
So I went back and would substitute God for, heaven or
higher power,
eternity. Mm-hmm. Or I would just not use it. So when I look back at, you know, some of the scenes, and when it is used, it has
much more of an impact.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. And he switched some scenes around where we put one scene and that was in the beginning of the play, and we switched it around, like the one that you saw in New York, that now has been moved to a different part of the play. So, and it's much more provocative.
Really?
Yes.
Some spicy, sexy scenes.
Yeah, it's much, it is very spicy. But for a reason, it's not done in a gratuitous way, but it's used, you know, some of the backdrop of this, as I may have mentioned to you, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic father. And, you know, there's things that you witness as a young person, the powerlessness of it and where it takes you. And I don't want to back off that subject matter in the play and how this sort of affects Patience, our lead character. And so part of that, is part of the play for a specific reason, because it is the false intimacy of lust that takes you to the edge of the cliff.
Yes, especially coupled with addiction and alcoholism.
It's, yeah.
I mean, lust in itself may always give the impression of a false intimacy because it doesn't hold much depth or weight.
Right, yeah.
But heightened with feelings under the influence make it completely surreal, I think.
Exactly. And I can't get into specifics because it would give away the play, but it does take the carriage to the edge of the cliff.
I'm sure.
And so, you know, what Larry has done is he's very Spartan in his, he'll send me three or four sentences and there are always suggestions. But it's the way that you've coached me, through the years, which is, sometimes the most provocative, clear things are, things that have, that are not a 50-minute diatribe, but rather something that could be a sentence or two sentences. And then you have an aha moment.
Yes.
You know?
That push moment, that epiphany.
Right.
That thing that makes you pivot and go in a different direction.
Right.
Really and truly.
Yeah.
And it's been very powerful for you.
Well, it really has, because for me, listen, unless something's burning inside of you, and for me, the subject matter of this play is forgiveness. That's a really powerful subject matter for me. Why is that? Because I had to forgive my father. I had to reach a place that either he was going to own me or I was going to own, you know, I had to figure out to, you know, either let go or be dragged, as they say.
Right. But for you, that came after his death, yes?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at it, you know, I've kind of been holding on to a lot of those things in a negative way, I have to say. And listen, that toxicity, you know, there's a saying, you know, bitterness is like swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die.
Yes.
You've heard that one, right?
I love that one.
And because of my demeanor, people must think, you know, hey, I'm easygoing, I have a great sense of humor. But lurking underneath all of that was restless, irritable, and discontent because I had not dealt with that. Now, going to a therapist or, you know, I don't know, for some people that worked, but for me it wasn't. It was putting pen to paper. And that was my cathartic journey with the forgiveness of my dad.
Great.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
So here you are, a couple of years later, mm-hmm. out of Guiding Light, now a very, very excited, budding writer with the potential for the play to be on Broadway?
Well, you know, I'm not gonna, sure I can go there, but I can't talk about it right now, but let me just put it this way. There's somebody who is very interested in the play. And if it doesn't live in New York, it'll live somewhere.
It will.
Yeah, I really believe that. And, you know, I have Larry championing it, you know, and Larry, you know, Larry has a specific identification with the material in the play, too. So now we're in the last week of, you know, doing the edit on the play. Larry's given me some major notes that I had to really ponder and go back to the drawing board a little bit. And because, you know, it was painful to kind of take the note that he gave me, meant that he was hitting on something. Because if it doesn't mean anything, why are you even writing something?
Exactly.
You know.
What was particularly painful?
Well, I think he, you know, he said something to me about, you know, one of the characters is an alcoholic in the play. And he said something to me that made me think of going deeper into this character's alcoholism. And he said something, I don't know exactly what it was said to me, but he goes, look, he said, you know, there's something else that's missing here. And I want you to think about it. And I did. And when I thought about what it was it was the secrets that alcoholics keep that kill them. Not the alcohol necessarily, but it's the secrets.
Give me an example.
Well, I think, and I've seen this in all the time, is the people that we love the most, we don't tell them what's in our heart. And that can live in you for the rest of your life. And it's interesting, the people that love you the most won't necessarily address those things, those secrets. Secrets. Now, what are secrets? It could be anything, and it's not in this play, but let's just use a pedophile, for example. Uh-huh. The uncle or somebody who abused the child, and kids that live with that the rest of their life.
Yes,
and
that's the deep, kind of dark secrets. Deep,
yeah. Now, that's not the secret I'm talking about in my play.
Right.
But it has the sort of import that I'm, you know, discussing with you.
Yes.
I don't want to give away what it is in the play.
No, absolutely not.
But it's the secrets.
I understand. Yeah. And knowing addiction the way I do and working in the field for close to 13 years now, we understand that if you are an addict, an active addict, there are so many things you want to hide because of your own shame and guilt.
Right.
And because you don't want to be exposed. Exposure is deadly.
Yeah.
You know, being naked and exposed in front of everybody else for the person that you are, for the fraud that you think you are.
Yep.
And that's a very debilitating state for someone to keep their secrets bottled up. But the irony of it is that most people don't realize that the people around them really have an inkling into their secrets.
Of course they do. And that's so funny you mention it, because in the play, the mother knows patient's secrets.
Of course.
But she never gave a voice to it.
Exactly.
She knew it all along.
Yes.
And that's the irony to it, is all those years that are wasted because two people didn't talk to each other. And it's the pride goeth before the fall. It's one of my other favorite things is pride is the worst thing that could ever happen to a person, is to humble yourself to somebody, to be the person to break the ice. You know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, right?
Right.
And you know, what comes first, love or respect?
Right.
You know, for a man, well, man wants to be respected, woman wants to be loved.
Right.
So what comes first? So it's sort of like, you know, are you going to be the big person in the room and open that door?
And expose yourself.
Yeah.
And if you begin to realize that people who know you and care about you already can see these things,
right,
sometimes it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah. And so that note transforms this play in my opinion, because it makes my protagonist that more empathetic, that I had to get to the specificity of her secret, what her secret was. What made her become an alcoholic, and why she did the things that she did. So once I open that door, I go, wow, now we understand the mother, who she knew all along that she was drinking. She knew all along. And the mother, who was not entirely empathetic in this play, you love her by the end of the play, because she was there standing side by side with her daughter, just kind of waiting for her to give a voice to her pain.
And that's exactly what happens in the relationship between people that are actively involved in alcohol or drugs and the family around them. The family dynamic is so important and so acute. And people that are actively under the influence could possibly think, nobody will know if I'm drinking. Nobody will know if I'm doing drugs. Mm-hmm. I want to keep this secret inside. But families know. Everybody knows. And then it becomes this big, dark secret in the families, because nobody wants the outside world to know. So it's a combination of deep, dark secrets all the time.
When we did our production at Ella Fitzgerald Theater in Maryland, we wanted a Q&A afterwards with the audience, and to talk to them about the subject matter, which is, you know, the destructive forces of alcoholism and forgiveness. And we had like 400 people there, and not one person left. And the question
after the play,
and the question I posed was, how many people here whose life has been affected by alcoholism or addiction? Every single person. This idea that maybe 30 or 40%. It's not true.
There's no longer 6 degrees of separation.
No, everybody raised their hands. It became like, I guess, an Al-Anon meeting, where people just started talking about how the addiction has affected their lives. And in fact, one man came up to me afterwards, who was a very big personality or big person in the area. And he had tears in his eyes. And he said, as I was watching your play, right now my son's on a run. and we don't even know if he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly the subject matter touched people, but I don't think the play is specific to alcoholism. It could be addiction. The play really poses is, what are you in bondage to the exclusion of living your life and to your family and everything else?
I see.
So that's really the message. It's, you know, is it perfectionism? Is it gambling? Is it being right? You know, there's... You know,
is it controlling?
It is.
Right, all of those things.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting thing. So when do you think we'll hear about what's happening next?
Well, I think the next step is that Larry will take the script to some really amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see where it goes. And one of the biggest things is just being patient and seeing what they say. And then just to back up a little bit, Cynthia Watrow's plays Patience is absolutely transformative.
What is Cynthia, in addition to Guiding Light, how would fans also know Cynthia Watrow?
I think she played Liddy or Libby on Lost. No, I didn't watch Lost, but she was one of the stars of
the
Lost.
TV show. Yes.
She's a Drew Carey show. She's done a lot of nighttime television.
Yes.
Cynthia and I, ironically, she was like my first wife on Guiding Light.
Uh-huh.
She was wife number one.
You go way back.
Yeah. And so we worked for a short period of time, but I when I worked with Cynthia and she's, I knew she had big things ahead of her. This was the best actress I've ever worked with.
So not only have you written the play, but you are acting in it. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
What character do you play?
I play Chuck Ebert, and Chuck is this sort of evangelical, wacko, crazy church guy. And he comes into their home and eventually kicks them out of the church because of Patience's involvement in doing a play called Anna Christie by Eugene O'Neill, where she plays a prostitute. And but she plays this part because Anna Christie gets redeemed for her sins.
Sure.
She gets forgiven. And the whole idea is that the only forgiveness she found is in this play that she's done at a little community theater down the road. So Cynthia was just amazing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that you will come back to us when you have something more to tell us about Breathing Under Dirt. Is there any other project you have your eye on? Are you thinking about?
I'd like to resurrect Steamboat.
I loved Steamboat.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about Steamboat.
Steamboat is a web
completely
series.
Completely the opposite spectrum
from
this.
Yeah, Steamboat
right?
is a very, most people listening today would not know I'm a total goofball, because that's what I am. I'm a total goofball. And Steamboat is kind of like the Office version of a dying soap opera. So
there
it's
you
a
go.
It's a soap opera. The ratings are in the tank. This Greek guy, a Dirk, and I are roommates. He's this Greek guy who's 50, and he tells everybody he's 38. He's a misogynist. He chases the girls. And I actually play the straight guy on there, and it's about the show going down the tubes, and everybody is just trying to hang on to their jobs. And we shot 7 or 8 episodes. It won.
It was streaming for a while, yes?
Yeah, it was streaming for a while. And we got a couple looks with some major cable companies, but it wasn't fully ready yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a great idea there. So I'm actually going back and looking at that.
Like about a half hour comedy?
Yes, I think so. But, you know, with Amazon and Hulu and all these great venues, I actually think maybe at 15 minutes it might live better that way, you know?
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, it also gives you the opportunity to let yourself go in another way, right? It's another cathartic release.
Yeah, and I think with humor, true humor comes from truth. You know, from pain. So the great thing about writing is, whether it's drama or pain, whatever it is, everything I think comes from pain. That's my thought. So humiliation or being embarrassed, which my character does on Steamboat all the time, it comes from things that I think everybody can relate to.
I understand. Sometimes, unfortunately, we laugh at other people's pain.
Yes.
We find humor in it, and sometimes we do that simply because it's a release. We're afraid to feel the pain ourselves, so it's easier to laugh about it sometimes.
I think that's right. I
mm-hmm.
think that's right, Ellen.
Let's talk a little bit about what coaching has meant to you.
I think, you know, and I'm just speaking for myself, is that when you wake up in the morning, you're living in your head. and you have a choice. You know, do I get out of my head and have a plan? Do I have a plan? What's my plan for today? What's my action plan? Or do you live in fear? And those are the two choices. Do I live in fear of I don't know, I have nothing, no plan? Or do I have a plan? It's kind of simple. And so when you gave me that advice, which really, I think, had you not given me that advice, I would have been I would have been in a fear moment. It's just, it's like a, you know, it's a yes or no question sometimes that you would ask me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have friends? Yes. Do you have friends that will help you? Yes. Go to five friends and ask them for help.
Right.
Call them up. Kay, right. You know.
This is what you need to do today.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
And also,
which, by the way, just keep your thought, which, by the way, takes, it's a daily discipline. It's something that you easily forget.
Yes.
Because we, by nature, let our fear take over mm-hmm. our lives. So, you know, do I live in fear or do I live in hope? And so I think it takes constant coaching to stay on track.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
And also somebody being that cheerleader, like I tell my listeners and I've been telling the people that are listening to the podcast, that as a life coach, I'm a cheerleader. To be in your corner and say, mm-hmm. you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, when you don't think you can or when you're afraid to.
Well, to have you there when I did my production meant a lot to me. So part of life and is having those people show up, and you've always showed up for me in every way, and I've always been appreciative. I will always be appreciative of that. So there's the people who coach you, and then there's the people who coach you and then show up, and you've done both.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I need to tell you that I know you for a long time. We know each other for a very long time, and even though we've just had a coach and client relationship for a few years, I can see how far you have come. Mm. And I am so thrilled with the play and with your creative talent. And I see that you are a true writer. So that's something else as well. I mean, that we can understand that we can reinvent ourselves. You didn't start out being a writer.
I did not. I never thought about writing, quite honestly. And sometimes there's a moment in your life, and for those people who are, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 and think it's too late. Nothing. That's another lie that you're telling yourself.
That's right.
The annoying negative thoughts, I call ants, is it's never too late. You just have to make the decision, because there'll always be people around you who say you can't do something. And, you know, my father would tell me, you can't do this, you can't do that if you do this. Those things propelled me to pursue the things I always wanted to do. So, yeah, if you would have told me when I was in my 30s that I was going to be writing a play, I'd never thought that would be possible. But I had to go through some pain for me, them just as this writer. I needed to experience some humiliation, some pain.
Some personal struggles.
Some personal struggles, and say, do I look at my side of those things, or do I choose to point the finger at somebody else and not take responsibility for it?
Right.
So the real healing and the potential of growth for me was looking at what my side of the street is. And once I did that, that's when some peace and serenity started entering my life.
Because it's coupled with humility, and with humility, it brings a realism that we could not have seen before. We're not looking at ourselves with rose-colored glasses anymore. Stripping ourselves bare and being honest and truthful with ourselves.
And being kind to yourself.
Being kind.
Being kind, because, you know, we catastrophize our lives because we've made a mistake. You know, everybody has some good in them. So it's just being kind to yourself.
Exactly. And also, most importantly, knowing that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. No matter how bad you think things are right now, you will come out of it. You will move forward, and good things will come. And that's what's happened for you.
Yeah. Thanks.
And I'm really excited to have you here. Thank you so much for taking the time. I do really appreciate it. And we'll hear back from you when you are moving forward
with the play. I hope to have some good news soon.
Very good, yeah. Michael. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here today.
That was an amazing and enjoyable interview with my coaching client, actor and playwright Michael O'Leary. This is Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, saying thanks for listening, and remember, everybody needs a little push.
From the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, New York.
The Pushy Broad from the Bronx would like to thank her production team, songwriter, composer, musician, and soundman, Sam Goche, voice artist and announcer, Taylor Goche. Oh, that's me. And thanks to collaborative writer and assistant production manager, Richard Torres, virtual assistant and social media guru, Kimberly Studdard. Special thanks to Laura Kravitz, production manager, and Susan Herman, collaborative writer. And a very special thanks to Love Love Studios in Brooklyn, for recording and mixing our music.
Here is disclaimer information that we are required to produce.
Professional coaches provide an ongoing partnership designed to help clients produce fulfilling results in their personal and professional lives. Coaches help people improve their performances and enhance the quality of their lives. Coaching services received from certified life coach Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, are not offered as a substitute for professional mental health care or medical care, and are not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any mental health or medical conditions. The Pushy Broad from the Bronx is not acting as a mental health counselor or a medical professional. All comments and ideas offered by Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, are solely for the purpose of aiding her audience in achieving their goals, and hopefully keep you smiling in the process.